The construction industry in Indiana has depended on Quality Supply and Tool, a local family-owned business, to deliver quality sales and service over the last 25 years. The employees make the difference, like sales expert Nick Worley.
What sets us apart is we only offer quality tools and supplies from quality manufacturers. We have a quality trained sales and service staff knowledgeable of the products we sell and offer. Quality. It's in our name.
On South Harding Street in Indy, plus Bloomington and Jeffersonville, Quality Supply and Tool thinks outside the box. Store.
Only the best run here at the Indianapolis 500.
Mario, who do you feel you'll have to beat in this year's race?
People like A.J. Foyt and Bobby Unser, for instance.
Stand by for the checkered flag.
Absolutely incredible. Danny Sullivan spun in front of Mario Andretti.
A.J. has done it.
Beyond the Bricks with jQuery and Mike Thompson. Brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5. The Fan.
And while myself, jQuery, Mike Thompson as well, and Landon Kunz are inside the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center, it is only fair that we start tonight's show by saying that this radio station that is allowing for you to hear our voices, whether it be over the radio, whether it be in podcast form, is the underneath the ownership umbrella of Radio 1 and Urban 1 Radio. I mention that only because, Mike, tonight's a night where we profile some of those who make it possible for us to have seen great race cars and great race drivers and great races at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, because it's ownership night, right? We're going to give a spotlight on some of those whose names maybe you heard a little about, or maybe you didn't know the name, but who made it possible for race car drivers to race in the Indianapolis 500.
Yeah, that's correct. I thought we could shout out some of the owners that you may know something about, and that'll be in our last segment. One of the most famous owners of all time, obviously, who owns the track now, but also some owners that you may have heard the name, but you may not know much about that particular car owner. So should be a fun show.
One of the, of course, I guess if you wanted to go buy flowers right now in Indianapolis, you could buy some McNamara. You could go to McNamara Florist, but there was a time where one of the most popular race cars was the McNamara Special. The McNamara Special cars were owned by Lee Elkins, and that owner happens to be our first spotlight tonight. Donald Davidson had talked about him previously in radio installment, and Donald, of course, is the historian emeritus of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, and his words on Lee Elkins.
Lee Elkins was at the Speedway from 51 through 59, the McNamara Specials, sometimes with two cars, and he normally, the drivers that he tended to hire were, they wouldn't fit in as Penske drivers, let's just say that. He had Andy Linden, he liked Ed Elysian, he liked Mike Nazaruk, he liked Dick Rathman. All of his guys were just real tough nuts. And he had a fifth with Dick Rathman at the Speedway in 56, so I am jumping around all over the place here. Fifth with Mike Nazaruk in 54. And he had sprint cars. At one time he had three sprint cars, and they were all top light. It was always outstanding equipment, but the drivers, I mean, they tended to be ex-military and tattoos, and occasionally would get into a disagreement in at a watering hole. Anyway, 59 was the last year, and then in 19 he came back in with a midget, and I'm trying to think what the year this was. John Batts from Jamestown, Indiana, was the driver, and I can't remember where this. Well, it might have been about 66 or 67, and Chuck Arnold, and then he started. He was in midgets, and then he got into sprints, and then he bought an Indianapolis car for Bill Puterbaugh in 1975. He ran Puterbaugh in 75, 76, 77, and I'll just say he was getting along in life by that time. He was a real crusty old devil and really ornery, which is maybe he had why he chose some of the drivers that he did, but he really liked Puterbaugh. And so they bought a car from Patrick Racing Team, George Bignotti, and they took delivery of the car, and they and Pewterboro qualified. Now, Pewterboro had been at the Speedway since 68 with a ride almost every year and would never make it and, so you know, get bumped or have qualifying problems and everything like that. And so, but he would keep coming back year after year. So here he is like 7 years later, and he finally makes the show. And we mentioned earlier the race was stopped short because of rain. He got seventh, won Rookie of the Year. But I talked to Bignotti afterwards, and I said, you know, I think that's really nice that apparently there was nothing to do with the to the car, that you basically turned it over to them ready to run. And he said, yeah, he said, I told them, you know, don't touch anything. It's set up to qualify. Just read a little practice. It's John Cock could drive it or Dallaback could drive it. It's set to go. And I said, well, I think that's really decent that you did that. And a lot of people would have said, hey, here's all the parts. You figure it out. And he said, well, he said, there's two reasons why we did that. He said, I'm proud of the reputation. And he said, I didn't want the word getting around that I, you know, Bignotti sold somebody a piece of junk. And then he said, the other thing was, we really like Pewterboro. And I remember that very well. Mm. Anyway, so he finished 7th in 75, 12th in 70, or 12th in 77 was the last time. A rather unfortunate thing happened there, and I won't go into that because we're running out of time.
The 1960s was obviously an era where there was a ton of innovation and excitement of coming out and seeing different cars that, as I always say, Mike, back in that era, it was like people were coming out of the lab, right? You know, they'd been in a basement or in a lab or in a garage, I'm speaking figuratively, working on the new machine that they would roll out in Indianapolis in May. And that really, in that era, I think, is part of what made Indianapolis so special, is the fact that you had so many different looks and shapes and ideas of race cars. And that's part of how a lot of these owners and a lot of these race cars became so special to people.
Oh, I agree. I mean, the fact that you kind of joked there a second ago about, you know, cars coming out of the basement. There was a car that was famous, Basement Bessie, that came literally out of a basement. So, you know, the fact that there were so many people doing their own thing, and in certain cases, we'll hear in a few minutes about people who are copying other people and doing their own thing and making interesting chassis. So, you know, interesting. The era was so so interesting from you had the Lotuses, but then you had, you know, a guy like who we're going to talk about next, Fred Gerhardt, doing his own thing. And so, you know, you had, you know, Huffaker and so many different chassis out there. So you're right. The innovation was very, very special in that era.
You mentioned Fred Gerhardt had some of the best cars of the 60s. Donald Davidson on it.
Fred Gerhardt had a long career in racing. Midgets, he owned midgets. Bill Vukovich Sr. drove for Gerhardt, and I think Johnny Parsons as well. But Vukovich won, you know, some major midget races for Fred Gerhardt. As far as the Speedway was concerned, the first car that he had back here was called the Las Vegas Club Special, and Bill Cheeseburg qualified that and got bumped. And then in 58, he had Johnny Parsons Sr., that is, started on the outside of the second row and got tangled up in the first lap accident that took the life of Pat O'Connor, which was a really sad day. But the light moment is that a number of cars were taken out and damaged permanently. Some were able to get back in and get some repairs made and then go off and rejoin the race. And others just stalled and had to wait for a tow. And Parsons was one of those. And he was standing by the car, and somebody, it was in turn three, and an infield person looking through the fence asked him if he wanted a drink, and he said yes. So they gave him a bottle of 7-Up, and then the tow truck comes along, pulls Parsons, the engine fires, and he comes back into the pit. So here's the crew waiting for Parsons, waiting, and then here he comes in for the pit stop, and he's holding a 7-Up bottle, which, you know, they didn't, then he had to explain to them what happened, because of course they didn't have the two-way radios in those days. Anyway, Gerhardt, the next year, had Bardol for a sponsor. Johnny Parsons waved off on a qualifying attempt and then actually announced his retirement from racing at that point. So Paul Russo drove it in the race. And I'll just quickly, you know, run through these. Jack Turner drove a Bardolph special for Gerhard, and it was in when the rear engine cars came in, and I'm really hurrying the thing along here. When the rear engine cars sort of began to take hold in 63-64, Gerhard decided that he would build rear engine cars, and I don't know the order that this happened, but anyway, he built a car for himself, or had a couple of cars built for himself, and then made them available as customer cars. So it wasn't long before, probably, I think there might have been more Gerhards than any other chassis, because, you know, Gurney was building Eagles, and people were trying to get hand-me-down Lotuses, but Gerhard, you could just place an order and they'd build one for you. So George Snyder drove a Gerhard in 65 as a rookie, and then Mel Kenyon drove that same car the next year and got fifth as a rookie, and then in the summer of 65, Gordon Johncock won the Milwaukee 200, and this is on a day where so much attention was given to A.J. Foyt. I mean, this is a fantastic day. It's the day that A.J. Foyt, rear engine car had not arrived, so he qualified a dirt car, not a roadster, but a dirt car on the pole, and then ended up finishing second. And it was a fabulous day, but it overshadowed the fact that Gordon Johncock won the race with a Gerhard. And it was, not only was it the first time he had driven a rear engine car, but he had never even tested one. And in those days, they were one-day affairs. So Johncock did not drive a rear engine car in his life until that morning.
Wow.
So many of the car owners were also known as car builders. So they owned a car, they would build a car. That includes Grant King. Donald Davidson on the man that brought us the Kingfish chassis.
Then in 1972 was the first of the Kingfishers. The Kingfish was cars built by Grant King for the Speedway. Well, the 72 Kingfish was actually a copy of a 1971 McLaren M16. And how he copied it was they took a Goodyear calendar that had a profile of the car, they measured it up on the wall, and then duplicated it on the floor and drew the chalk marks and built a car. I mean, it gets better. In 1973, the 73 Kingfish was a copy of an Eagle, of a 1972 mm-hmm. Eagle. And I remember I was in the Grant King shop in the spring of 1973 because I was getting stuff to take down to the Channel 20 auction. And I went to all the places to pick up the stuff to take down there. And so I get this first look at the 73 Kingfish, which was a 72 Eagle. And that was the first time I realized that what they did was that there was no frame. There was the front part was the tub where the driver sits, and that the engine was hooked on to the back of the behind the driver where the driver sat, and that the engine, I don't know if you call it a stress member, so here I'm, you know, I'm not a gearhead, but anyway, the thing is there was no frame, that the engine actually was the race car, part of the race car. And I thought, but you're kidding me. And when I looked at that, and I thought, because the engine was just bolted onto the back of where the driver sits, and I thought it was almost that if the driver was too heavy that the thing would break in like a Laurel and Hardy car and fall in half. And so, but anyway, they said, no, that's how we do it now. And so she said, I don't know why Grant's not getting more orders, because the new Gurney Eagles, they're an exorbitant price. And it was either $30,000 or $35,000 for a chassis. $30,000, I think it was. And that was an exorbitant price for then. So I said, well, how much are one of these? And she says, well, she said, I can tell you what we've got in it. $5,000. Are you ready for that? $5,000 for a chassis, and don't laugh. The chassis that I looked at qualified for the inside of the third row with Steve Krzyzewski. Anyway, Grant King, just to hurry along here, he built a number of sprint cars, only a couple of midgets, but he built outstanding sprint cars and outstanding championship dirt cars. You know, the Vels Funnelly Jones car, like the Johnny Lightning Special and all of those. Those were Grant King's. And He ran a three-car team in 76, ended up as a reluctant car owner, but he had, you know, Sheldon Kinzer, Bob Harkey, and John Martin were the drivers.
Mike, I think when you talk about owners and just, you know, innovators and then just overall speed champions or those that were constantly in the quest of speed and became synonymous with it, especially of that era, Mike, we got to talk about Mickey Thompson.
Oh, I agree 100%. I mean, Mickey Thompson was known for bringing, you know, radical, interesting ideas. I mean, obviously, some of them worked, some of them didn't work. Some of them, sadly, there was disastrous consequences in 1964 with the car that, Dave McDonald was fatally injured in. But, Mickey Thompson brought some really unique machinery to the Speedway in the 1960s. And he was an innovator. He was involved, obviously, he was a drag racing legend as well. And so, it was a really interesting era to have Mickey Thompson there.
Donald Davidson on Mickey Thompson.
And in 62, he actually had built three cars by a Brit who had worked for Lotus, although the cars actually looked more like a Cooper than a Lotus. And they had three of them at the track. They had Buick engines, and Dan Gurney qualified middle of the third row and stayed in the first 10 and then dropped out. And I think it was a transmission failure. They wanted to make everybody understand it was not an engine failure. Then the next year, they built, three new cars that were much lower and had very small wheels and tires. And they were probably the first low-profile wide tires that the Speedway had ever had. And the only one of those cars to make the race was Dwayne Carter. Bastian Gregory got bumped in one. And then they had a couple of the older cars. So Al Miller got ninth in one. Then in 64, they came with three cars that were radically different in shape. And there's some discussion about whether they were the 1963 cars rebodied or whether one of them might have been new or they were all new. That's never really been clear. But they showed up with the front wheels enclosed and the rear wheels were exposed. And it ended up that a modification was changed. It ended up that there was a tragic accident involving Dave McDonald at the end of the second lap, not the end of the first lap, as everybody thinks, that ended up with the double fatality with Dave McDonald and Eddie Sachs both losing their lives. And McDonald's car was a V8 Ford, and it was running on gasoline. Of the three cars, Bastian Gregory ended up missing the show. Eddie Johnson was in the other one and was out. I think he ran six laps and had a gear shift problem. The next year, then, Mickey Thompson came back with something completely different. He entered one car, and it was front drive. Nobody had run front drive for years, and they had a really odd way of starting the thing. They pushed it up like a ramp. Anyway, Bob Mathauser made a qualifying attempt, and I think he waved off one time because they weren't quite there with speed and then blew an engine, I think, on the next attempt. In 66, Mickey was not there. And then in 67, he came back with two cars that were Chevy, modified Chevy powered. There was a front engine car that Sam Sessions drove, which I thought was really neat. It looked like a dragster. And then there was a rear engine car that Gary Congdon was in. And neither one of them made it. They never even made qualifying attempts. The rear engine car came back again in 68. Danny Ongais was entered, turned down because he'd never, had very little racing experience at that time. It was almost exclusively drag racing, and so they sent him home, and then he came back later, and then, of course, Ongais then became a front runner for a few years. But Bill Putabar, right, I believe, would be the last driver that was ever in a Mickey Thompson car.
Owning race cars has not always been and was never exclusively, per se, just a man's game. Female owners at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. We'll take a look at that when we return to Beyond the Bricks.
The construction industry in Indiana has depended on Quality Supply and Tool, a local family-owned business, to deliver quality sales and service over the last 25 years. The employees make the difference, like sales expert Nick Worley.
What sets us apart is we only offer quality tools and supplies from quality manufacturers. We have a quality trained sales and service staff knowledgeable of the products we sell and offer. Quality. It's in our name.
On South Harding Street in Indy, plus Bloomington and Jeffersonville, Quality Supply and Tool thinks outside the box. Store.
Hey, all. I'm Jamie Lynn Sigler, a mom, actor, and advocate. I know how overwhelming it can be trying to decide which treatment is right for you. I've been there. But you should know you're not alone. You can do this. Start with some research, talk to the community, and most importantly, don't be afraid to ask your doctor questions. You might find results that speak for themselves. That's how I landed on Kesimpta. Ask your doctor if Kesimpta, ofatumumab, could be right for you. You can check out the details at kesimpta.com.
This is Beyond the Bricks, brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
Jake Query, Mike Thompson, Beyond the Bricks, taking a look at legendary car owners over the history of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Mike, the reality is, you know, we've talked about, as you mentioned, Roger Penske, obviously, who now owns the Speedway itself. Mickey Thompson, one of those that we talked about, Lee Elkins. But over the course of time, you know, we can't forget about the fact, and it's a very important aspect of it, that women and their involvement in ownership has also dated back at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway perhaps longer than people realize.
Yeah, I mean, one of the teams that really, the female car owners that really shined in that era was Bessie Lee Paoli. I mean, her team, they were a championship team. And she wasn't allowed even in the pits at that point. And that, so you just think about the things that she overcame, and the barriers that were put up in front of her to be a female car owner, that she overcame. And they were a race winning, you know, championship team, and she's not even allowed in the pits with her car. So it was obviously a different time, but there were female car owners, and another one that we'll probably hear a little bit more about this in this clip. But you know, Mary Holman George was a championship car owner as well, and successful in her own right. So definitely a different time, but there were pioneering women who were out there, not allowed even in the pits, but they wanted to be a part of the sport.
Donald Davidson on female owners.
The claimant that you hear a lot was a lady named Bessie Lee Paoli, who owned the second place car in 1953. And in fact, there was a lady named Lydia Lockery that owned the car that Steve Chessy drove in 87. And she believed that she was the first. But unfortunately, there were some before her. Believe it or not, the winning entrant in 1929, Ray Keach's owner, Simplex Piston Ring Special, the entrant was M.A. Yeagle, and the M stood for Maud. It was a husband and wife, but she was the car owner, Maud Yeagle, and she owned cars. They were from, I think, Philadelphia or somewhere over east, and so they owned cars and actually were entrants up through 1932, but she purchased a car actually from, I got to think how this was now. Frank Lockhart's widow sold the two Lockhart cars. One of them went to Ray Keach, or went to Mrs. Yeagle, purchased a car, and then also another car was purchased by the widow of Norman Batten. There was a Marion Batten. So actually, there were female car owners. She entered a car in 1929. So in 29, technically, you had two female car owners. So no, Sarah is not the first.
Who before Sarah was as actively involved as the... Were these ladies the decision makers? Were they in charge? Were they front and center? That type of thing.
Bessie Lee Paoli, I mean, she was married, but she was the car owner. But she couldn't get in the garage area or the pits. And that was at other tracks as well. So she would sit in the grandstands, and then sort of there's pictures of her sort of on the fence and talking to the crew and everything. To the best of my knowledge, she never made an issue of it. it. She just accepted that. And then the other thing, too, is that she sold her championship car, which actually was a combination dirt car and speedway car. She sold it to Miss Mary Holman. So Tony Holman's daughter, who, you know, eventually to become Mary Holman George, she had her first sprint car in 1954, and then she bought the champ dirt car from Bessie Lee Paoli. And again, was that the first occasion on which a lady sold a race car to another lady? And the answer is no, because it happened with Lockhart's widow. Well, Lockhart's widow selling to Maud Yeagle in 1928. And then I've got to think of with Marion Batten. She sold one. Did she sell one to Yeagles? I'll have to stop and think about that.
Bill Vukovich, of course, is one of the most legendary names at the Indianapolis 500, a two-time winner who was fatally injured in pursuit while leading for his third Indianapolis 500. His cars were owned by Howard Keck, who also absolute legend at the Speedway and successful, but also one of the more enigmatic owners in IMS history.
Howard Keck, yeah, boy, he was mysterious. Howard Keck was his company was the Superior Oil Company, and I think he might have been second generation or even third generation, but at least second generation. And he was a really interesting guy because he actually looked older than he was. He was very, very reclusive. His cars at the Speedway, they were always top-rate equipment. And 48 through 54 were the years that he entered, and he had a front drive car that was very similar to the Blue Crown Specials that Jimmy Jackson drove in 48 and 49 to 10th and 6th respectively. Maury Rose was third in the rain shortened race in 50, and then in 51 Maury Rose had a wheel collapse and crash while he was running third. And then the new car, the first of the so-called Roadsters, was 56 with Vukovich. I'm sorry, with 52, with Vukovich, who led the greater part of the 52 race and dropped out, leading with 8 laps to go. Steering problem, then he won it clearly in 53 and then won it again in 54. Howard Keck also had a couple of other cars. He owned a Ferrari that the chief mechanics, Frank Kuhn and Jim Travers were the mechanics on the cars every year, and they did a lot of revolutionary stuff. They were the first to have fuel injection. They were the first to have disc brakes, and I think they were among the first to have mag wheels, and they were always experimenting. But the thing about Howard Keck was that he does not appear in any of the pictures. He was very, very reclusive. And we finally, somebody sent me, all these years, I'd look at the crew shots and think, I wonder which one of these fellows is Howard Keck. Maybe it's him, maybe it's this fellow, maybe it's that fellow. And when finally somebody gave me a picture and said, that's Howard Keck, I thought, I've never seen this fellow before in my life. And he did pass away. There was a very expensive divorce. And several years ago, he donated the winning car. The Vukovich winner came to the museum, but one of the terms was the car will never run. It will never leave the track, and it's a stationary display only. And a few years ago, like about 5 years ago, there was a big gathering of roadsters at Laguna Seca, and a very prominent man with some ties said, I'd like to have the Vukovich car out there. I think I can get it. And the way that you contacted the son was you would send a fax, and you would get a fax response. So there was no street address, no phone number, and not even an email. You would dial the number and send a fax, and you would get a fax reply. And the reply was no.
Wow.
But anyway, he always had first-rate equipment.
You know, it's interesting when you think about some owners, like, for example, the one we're going to hear about next, Mike. You might know about them for ownership, and then you look back historically and realize that they gave opportunity to drivers that later would become some of the biggest legends of the Speedway.
Yeah, that's the case, especially with the next person we're going to profile, Frank Arciero. I mean, he gave a chance to Al Unser, a car to take his rookie test in, and he also had the Rookie of the Year two different years back to back, actually. The rookie of the year drove a Frank Arciero car. So, guys like that, those are the type of people you need in the sport, giving opportunities to young drivers, things like that. So Frank Arciero was an important car owner.
Frank Arciero was a longtime car owner. In fact, the first time he entered was 1959, and he had a Maserati. And Shorty Templeman tried to qualify the car, and Bill Fowler, who later became chief mechanic for Dan Gurney, was on it as a crew member. He wasn't the chief mechanic. Then in 1965, Al Unser took his rookie test in a Frank Arciero rear-engine car with a Maserati. Never went to the qualifying line. He made the race, but driving for A.J. Foyt. But so Frank Arciero gave Al Unser his rookie test. And then in the 80s, he was running rear-engine cars and had third in 1987. Actually, he had back-to-back rookies of the year. In 86, he had Randy Lanier was 10th. And then in 87, rookie of the year and finishing third was Fabrizio Barbazza, who had his only 500 start that year.
The Morales brothers, Pancho Carter, comes to mind, a mainstay in the paddock for many years. Notably, you might remember the Alex Excellent Food Specials, Donald Davidson on the brothers, the Morales brothers that were owners.
There were five Morales brothers. Alex was the main one. The only one I knew was Gil, and I think it was five brothers. And a couple of them at least went back in racing to the 1930s. And they owned a series of sprint cars that were called the Tamale Wagon because they had they were in the Mexican food business. I think they had a restaurant or restaurants. And then there was a food line. There was Alex Foods, Alex Excellent Foods. And it was X and then Lent Excellent Foods. Gil Morales was on a Parnelli Jones team in the 1960s when I first showed up. In fact, he told me a lot of stuff. He talked about Ray Pixley, and he was the first person that told me that if they had left, when Bob Swanson relieved Ralph Hepburn in 1937 and then got out so Hepburn could finish the race and finish 2.16 seconds behind Wilbur Shaw, Gil Morales, I remember being one of several people that told me in 64, they said if they'd left Bob Swanson in the car, he could have won the race. So anyway, the thing is, he talked a lot about Legion Ascot Speedway. I think Alex must have been the eldest brother, or at least he was the one that had the food company. And then they came into the 500. And let's see, the first one they did was Jimmy Carruthers in 75. And then the best finish they had was Pancho was third in 82. I think they went from 75. I haven't thought about this in a while. They went from 75 until 90. I'm sorry, 75 until 83. Seventh with Pancho in 83, I think, was the last one. And it was like third in 82. Mike Mosley drove for them in 78. And I'm jumping around all over the place here. They had Vukovic in 76. And then actually Vuk started out in 77, but they had Lightnings and he wasn't comfortable with the car, so he got out of it and Foyt gave him a car. And so Vukovic drove for Foyt in 77. So Bobby Olivero was the only fellow in the 500 with a Morales car. Then 78, Olivero was struggling in practice, and on the last qualifying day, this was amazing, the practice, Sunday morning practice, final qualifying day, a beautiful day, and Bobby Olivero had kind of got stuck through the whole month, and Mike Mosley stepped into the car, and he went out and ran the slow first lap, and I think he ran like maybe five or six laps and came in and said, put it in the qualifying line. And I think that when it was noon, I think he might even have been the first off the line, if not one of the first, and he qualified. And that was just, typical amazing Mike Mosley from time to time, that I think from the time he stepped into the car until he had actually come in having qualified, I think was like maybe 12 laps total, 11 or 12 laps total. And so anyway, then Pancho Carter was the driver in, let's see, 80, 81. He was sixth in 80, dropped out in 81, third in 82, and seventh in 83. And then I think that that was the end for the Morales brothers as far as Indianapolis Motor Speedway was concerned.
The Morales brothers actually fielded Johnny Rutherford's final win in a car, driving a race car at the Michigan 500 in 1986. Johnny Rutherford, one of the true gentlemen in the sport, reminisced about that win with Mike 2 years ago.
I had so many things happen in front of me. I was trying to say, I can remember the one in particular is I went off into turn three and there was a strip of oil. I could see the oil on the track, so I straddled it. And as it got around, you know, into the corner pretty good, I'm face to face with Mario looking over the nose of his car at me as he'd spun in the oil. And there were several different situations that had happened that day, and it just all kind of, you know, I just took it easy and didn't struggle too much until the end. And then we were running, I think on the last yellow, and I started in the front of the thing. And I, the green dropped, and I took off, and I, you know, knew we were in the lead, and that I really stood on it, and we were running 217 miles an hour, and I was never challenged by Jose Legarza. And anyway, came around and won the race, and Staples never did tell me early on while we were after the restart that I was leading, you know, and I still, you know, just pushed as hard as I could, knew we were in good shape and won the thing. And it was a 500 miler, wasn't it?
Yeah, sure was.
Yeah. And so anyway, I just one of those times when you do what it takes and keep out of trouble and everything. And it was a great race. I really enjoyed going 500 miles at Michigan. It's a pretty tough deal anyway, but still, it was another victory.
And Mike, I know you've got your own memories of the 86 Michigan 500.
Yeah, I was at the 86 Michigan 500. It was rainy. It was windy at times. I mean, the wind was, it felt like at times was just crazy that day. And then Johnny Rutherford and Jose Legarza, that was actually, I think, Jose Legarza's best opportunity to get a win in the IndyCar series. But, you know, Johnny, that was just one of those days that Johnny just showed how important it was to have experience behind the wheel. You know, every time something came up and something was thrown at Johnny that day, you know, Johnny responded. And Pancho Carter was good that day. Jeff Brabham was good that day. But you know, you had a veteran guy. Johnny Rutherford knows how to win 500-mile races, and that's who came out on top. And winning the Michigan 500, people might forget in that day. Winning the Michigan 500, that was a difficult race to win. It was tough to win at Michigan in those days.
When we come back, the greatest owner of them all, certainly in terms of accomplishment at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, both in terms of trophies and in terms of his set of keys. That when we return to Beyond the Bricks.
In the construction business and tired of dealing with the indifference of big corporate suppliers, Quality Supply and Tool on South Harding Street understands. For over 25 years, owner Kevin Anne has had a different approach.
We at Quality Supply and Tool take pride in being a locally owned family business committed to service. And every customer's needs are different, and we truly believe in shaping our business to our customers' needs. That's what separates us from the competition.
That's Quality Supply and Tool with additional locations in Bloomington and Jeffersonville to serve Hoosiers better. Partner with Quality Supply and Tool and think outside the box. Store.
Hey all, I'm Jamie Lynn Sigler, a mom, actor, and advocate. I know how overwhelming it can be trying to decide which treatment is right for you. I've been there. But you should know you're not alone. You can do this. Start with some research, talk to the community, and most importantly, don't be afraid to ask your doctor questions. You might find results that speak for themselves. That's how I landed on Kesimpta. Ask your doctor if Kesimpta, ofatumumab, could be right for you. You can check out the details at kesimpta.com.
This is Beyond the Bricks, brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
You're looking at a marvel of automotive design. Every part state-of-the-art. The powerful Pennzoil Penske IndyCar. Roger Penske built it for reliability. It takes the skill of Rick Mears, IndyCar champ, to handle it. Turning over 10,000 RPMs, he needs a motor oil engineered for reliability to stand the strain. Pennzoil motor oil for tough engine protection, whatever you drive. Protection you can rely on. Pennzoil.
Roger Penske, the winningest owner at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, now the owner of the track itself, came to the Speedway with a three-year plan to win the 500 when he came with Sunoco on board and Mark Donohue behind the wheel. It actually took 4 years to conquer the Brickyard. Penske on the three-year plan.
You know, we came here, fortunately, with a great driver of Donohue. We were a team, a small team. We looked up to Foyts. We looked up to these guys that were just every day so fast. But, you know, we knew if we stayed on course, and I had a plan with Sun Oil Company, I said we can win this race in 3 years. You know, it took us 4 years really to do that. But, at the end of the day, the success we've had is because we've had so many good people that have worked for us and the continuity. I guess this year when we come to the racetrack, we'll have 600 to 700 years of experience on the team.
Mike, take me through Roger Penske, Rick Mears, and the three Ps.
Yeah, the three Ps is something that they talked about a lot, especially in the 80s and the 90s. But I asked Rick Mears about this. I told him, I said, Rick, I heard one time that the reason for the success at Penske Racing is three P's. And the first P is Penske himself, Roger Penske himself. The second P is people. And the third P is preparation. And he said, absolutely. And he gave me a great answer talking about Roger Penske's work ethic.
I've always said that. If you want to really feel like a bum, follow him for a week. You know, you'll realize you aren't as busy as you thought you were. But that's his desire. That's the love of the sport, the industry, just his work ethic in general.
John Menard is a longtime friend, of course, of Roger Penske's, and he agrees with Rick Mears regarding the work ethic of the captain.
Nobody gets up earlier in the morning works harder than Roger. And you know, I've seen it so often in my life that, you know, you make your own luck. And Roger's made his by hard work. And I think most successful people, I mean, there's a few guys that luck out, but most successful people, I think, can tell you the same thing. It's 99% perspiration that makes you successful.
Danny Sullivan went to work and drive for Roger Penske after he had success driving for Doug Shearson and discussed the pressure that goes into driving for the most successful team in IndyCar history.
I really wasn't thinking so much of expectations. It's just, you know, get to work here and put your best effort forward. There's also a pressure driving for Penske because they do have the track record. They do give you the best equipment. They've got a great set of, you know, guys, mechanics, management, the whole deal. And so there's a lot on your plate as well. It's like, hey, you're here now, but now the work really begins and you have to step up and deliver.
And the late Bobby Unser was asked about the joy of working with Roger Penske and said, literally, that's exactly what it was.
I mean, the development was so easy. Didn't have to do a sales job. Like, I didn't have to call Roger Penske to tell him that I wanted to run Michigan next week. He owns the racetrack. I want to run there next week. I don't have to ask Roger. I just tell the guys in the shop, put her on the truck, we're going. That's it. And I'd go there and I'd make discoveries. And that's what was so good about that with Penske. In other words, he did the same thing Dan used to do, only everything I wanted, anything I wanted. If I'd call Roger at 3 o'clock in the morning, he loved it. Oh, he just absolutely loved me to death if I'd call him, because my subconscious mind stays awake a lot at night. So I think up these things out of my subconscious mind, these crazy things that I do sometimes, and they work. And I'd call Roger on the phone and say, man, I just got another idea. Oh, boy, and he'd listen to me. He'd write it all down. And somebody had to write it down. I finally got to where I had to put an 8x10 next to my bed, start writing mine down, because I'd forget what I thought about. So that's where the Penske things happened. There's where the 81 car. I started developing with that car and started making new airfoils, new wings, new under trays for it, new everything aerodynamically.
Mike, simply put, when you walk around the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, even before Roger Penske owned it, but you can certainly see just the attention to detail that goes into every aspect of every approach. And obviously that has paid dividends in terms of their racing record.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. And I've always been interested in that story that, you know, that Doug Bowles talks about when Mr. Penske bought the Speedway. You know, Doug Bowles, he wanted to immediately get to work. He wanted to immediately, what do I need to see? Show me every inch of this place. I want to get to work immediately. And that's the preparation that Rick Mears talks about and the work ethic. And that's why he's been such an incredible success.
And to be the winningest owner is saying something, because as we have learned tonight, if you didn't already know it, there are owners that are great in various ways over the course of the history of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Thanks for listening to Beyond the Bricks.
These days, work is in trouble. We've outsourced most of our manufacturing to other countries. And with that, we sent away good jobs and our capability to make things. American Giant is a clothing company that's pushing back against this tide. They make all kinds of high-quality clothing and activewear, like sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more, right here in the USA. So when you buy American Giant, you create jobs in towns and cities across the country. And jobs bring pride. Purpose. They stitch people together. If all that sounds good to you, visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with promo code STAPLE20.